So welcome everyone. I am Norbert Bujaya. I'm a third year PhD candidate, and I shall be addressing Joseph Conrad's novella, Heart of Darkness. This novella has been a widely influential text across various fields and disciplines, right? So post-colonial studies, culture studies, literary studies in general. It has inspired a number of films. Maybe you are familiar with Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now, which is an adaptation of the novella. I assume that you have read the novella, or that you are at least very familiar with it, yes?
Sorry, can you speak a bit louder?
Okay, I'll try my best. Joseph Conrad spent 20 years working as a seaman, a sailor, from 1874 till 1894, and this experience of seafaring was very, very crucial to the subject matters of his writing. During Conrad's youth, in the 1860s and 70s, Africa was still, as a continent, relatively unknown to Europeans. There was still this idea of an unspeakable void about Africa that Europe then set out to missionize and to explore. It is an important period because it marked the high point in the European powers, I'm talking of Belgium, England, and France mainly, their scramble for Africa. So this meant the mass exploitation of African people in order to usurp and take resources ranging from gold, diamonds, and ivory. So you had a civilizing mission meant to missionize these people, and at the same time you had a concomitant rush for resources. In the novella, we start getting an idea of the geography that Conrad has in mind when he writes of Africa, even though he doesn't specify the places in Heart of Darkness. And Marlowe, the narrator, the second narrator, writes, he says, "But there was another one yet, the biggest, the most blank, so to speak, that I had been hankering after." He's talking about space, the space of Africa. "True, by this time it was not a blank space anymore. It had got filled since my boyhood with rivers and lakes and names. It had ceased to be a blank space of delightful mystery, a white patch for a boy to dream gloriously over. It had become a place of darkness." The novella deals with this idea of a blank space that turns into a space of darkness. So the European colonialist project that reconfigures African space into something dark, and we'll discover more about this darkness as we delve into the novella. The unknown turns into what Conrad describes as the unspeakable about Africa. So the crux, the kernel of Conrad's novella is the idea that instead of bringing light into this darkness as it had claimed, the civilizing mission actually uncovers the darkness within its own heart. Edward Said had pointed out that Heart of Darkness was so effective because it's essentially an imperialist text, a text that is formed through the imperialist frame of mind, and its politics and aesthetics, for this reason, were very appealing to the audiences Conrad was catering for. Conrad wants us to see how Kurt's great looting adventure, Marlowe's journey up the river in search of him, and the narrative itself, they share a common theme, and this is the European powers performing acts of imperial mastery over African people. As Conrad writes, "The exploration of Africa was prompted by an acquisitive spirit, the idea of riches in some form, the desire of trade or the desire of loot," notice the word loot, "disguised in more or less fine words." In Conrad's time, there was this whole imperial industry built around going to the furthest reaches of the earth, taxonomizing places, listing down names, a whole industry of cartography and map making, with the search for truth as its object, what the European frame of mind construed as truth. This whole drama of colonialism was accompanied by what Conrad has called those pertinacious searchers for El Dorado, who climbed mountains, pushed through forests, swam rivers, floundered in bogs, without giving a single thought to the science of geography. So the science of geography was a very specific job that Conrad had in mind, and he had in mind people like Mungo Park and David Livingstone, who were, of course, very well-known explorers of various regions of Africa in their own time. But scientific geography was also represented to Conrad by the polar explorers. At the time, there were many expeditions to the Arctic. And one such expedition was in 1857, when a certain Captain McClintock endeavored to go and discover some areas of the Arctic North. And Conrad dwells at length on McClintock's account. McClintock took this expedition in search of another explorer before him, who didn't make it back to England. And McClintock describes the intrigue and the excitement of this voyage. And this might have been, very possibly, one of the inspirations for Conrad's creation of Marlowe's Search for Kurtz. The most significant story, and arguably the most significant influence on Conrad in writing Heart of Darkness, was the exploits of Henry Morton Stanley, who was the explorer, notorious explorer, who in 1871, he was credited with finding the other colonialist explorer, David Livingstone, who was in Central Africa, and Henry Morton Stanley managed to discover him in Lake Tanganyika. But in Stanley's adventures, the moment that stands out is when Stanley and his men come across this island, Bambere Island, and the local community offered resistance to them. And there was some violence, and some of Stanley's men got injured and died. So what Stanley did was to return to England, get a 300-strong garrison, go back to Central Africa, back to Bambere Island, and he wiped out the whole population. And there are resonances of this in Kurtz's violence, in Kurtz's outright murderous attitude towards the indigenous communities in his mad, as Conrad describes it, search for ivory. So Stanley spoke of opening up Africa to the light of Christianity. And later he argued that Africans, I quote, respect only force, power, boldness, and decision. And he showed this boldness and decision in his massacre of the inhabitants of Bambere Island. Stanley received much criticism in the UK for this murderous act. But in Brussels, King Leopold II had other plans for him. King Leopold II was the king of Belgium who, since 1850, had been eyeing Central Africa as a possible Belgian colony. And King Leopold was influenced by a particular story that appeared in the Times in England. And this journalist wrote about the unspeakable riches of Central Africa and about the need for an enterprising capitalist to go there and make the most of it. So King Leopold called Stanley, got him to work for him, and Leopold's interest was mainly in using the technologies that were developing with the Industrial Revolution in order to get the native peoples to use them in order to enrich the Belgian coffers. And in 1879, he entrusted Stanley with an expedition to Central Africa, And the idea was described officially as a philanthropical and scientific mission under the patronage of the notorious International Association for the Exploration and Civilization of Africa. Know the politics of the words, okay? The exploration and civilization of Africa. And Stanley's job was to create a series of stations from a location called Boma to the uppermost tip of the Congo River. It's a huge, huge tract of land. And he had to construct these stations in order to facilitate the transport of resources looted by the Belgian colonialists. And he had to construct a road as well, all the way up to what then became known as Stanley Pool, the upper tip of the Congo River. The plan was ultimately to make the Congo Basin a Belgian colony. And in his account, Marlowe, in the novella, refers to the unspeakable rites performed for Kurt's gratification. And this phrase, the unspeakable rites that Conrad writes about, resonates with the Belgian atrocities that took place in the Congo Basin in the 19th century, right? So basically, the colonialist apparatus was unforgiving. They would crush down rebellion at all costs, and normally this took place with, there were many, many cases of executions and bodily mutilations. They used to just chop off their hands. So there is this whole intertext of the colonialist frame of mind in the novella. When Stanley returned to Brussels in 1890, and he returned to great acclaim, to great public acclaim, with the highest officials going to meet him at the train station and all of that, at the same moment that Stanley returned in 1890 to Brussels, Conrad arrived in Brussels himself in order to get confirmation of a three-year appointment as a pilot of a steamboat that he had to pilot up the Congo River. So Conrad was aware of Stanley and his exploits in Central Africa. And clearly, for those of you who've read the novella, this experience is clearly very present. So the importance of Conrad's own experience is central to the creation of the character of Marlowe in the novella. Conrad left for the Congo in May 1890, where he journeyed first to Matadi and then to Kinshasa, which is the central station in Heart of Darkness. So Conrad was following basically Henry Stanley's footsteps. In August of 1890, Conrad left Kinshasa, the central station, for the 1,000-mile trip to Stanley Falls, the uppermost tip of the Congo, on the steamer Roi de Belge. What Conrad was to realize, and he writes this in his diaries, along his journey was, I quote, "the distasteful knowledge of the vilest scramble for loot that ever disfigured the history of human conscience and geographical exploration." However, notwithstanding the autobiographical resonances between Marlowe's experience and Conrad's in the novella, Conrad detaches himself from the character of Marlowe, and he detaches the novella from autobiography very clearly. Marlowe's physical journey from the Thames to the Congolese heartlands takes the shape of a moral journey in which he confronts the workings of colonialism, and he's constantly making moral judgments on the brutal policies of colonialism in the Congo, in the Belgian Congo. And at the same time, it is a psychological, introspective journey undertaken by Marlowe, his audience, and the reader. The basic narrative structure of Heart of Darkness is that of a frame tale with inset stories. So you have a tale within a tale. You have an anonymous narrator who is recounting the events of an evening aboard the yacht, the Nelly, moored in the Thames. And his account introduces, so the anonymous narrator's account introduces and comprises Marlowe's narrative of his voyage in search of Kurtz. So Heart of Darkness has two narrators mainly. The anonymous first narrator, which provides a context for the interaction between Marlowe and his audience, the other people on the boat. And the narrator, which offers another viewpoint on Marlowe as he is narrating. Chinua Achebe, the Nigerian Nobel Prize winner and writer, in his critique of Heart of Darkness, he was very, very unforgiving of what Conrad wrote. He argues that this double displacement of Marlowe and the narrator, that Conrad's double displacement from the reader, is futile because Conrad does not provide an adequate alternative frame of reference by which we can judge the actions of Marlowe. So the actions of Marlowe are taken as read and for granted. There is no critique of Marlowe's discourse about his voyage up the river. So he accuses Conrad of depicting Marlowe as a liberal narrative voice who panders to the English tradition, which required all Englishmen of decency to be deeply shocked by atrocities in the Congo. Marlowe's story is first and foremost not about himself. It is about Kurtz and Kurtz's experience. So at first, as the narrative progresses, Marlowe tries to account for Kurtz as either a good or an evil force. And later he becomes even more attentive to Kurtz as a deep inner voice that could potentially explain Marlowe's own atavistic quest, okay, the quest towards primordial origins, the quest towards the darkness of beginnings. That is also a journey into the dark, hypocritical heart of the colonial enterprise. So after the novella's first section, Kurtz increasingly becomes the central figure of Marlowe's account. Kurtz promised eloquence, his gift of expression, promised Marlowe that Kurtz will reveal some profound and secret knowledge, whose mystery intensifies as Marlowe's steamboat delves deeper into the wilderness. Ultimately, when Marlowe eventually meets Kurtz, there is an anticlimax in relation to Kurtz. Marlowe is profoundly disenchanted by the encounter. And Marlowe eventually becomes skeptical about the possibility of any other explanation of or any other ultimate value inherent in colonialism. So the ultimate value that inheres in colonialism is, in Kurtz's final words, the horror, the horror. So Marlowe's journey back to the origins promises to take its meaning from Kurtz's prior experience. For him, Kurtz has already achieved the farthest point of navigation and the culminating point of experience. And this is where Marlowe wants to arrive. What he gets, however, from the degenerate Kurtz is no explanation, but the evidence of a deeply troubled soul. A broken narrative, and I quote, in desolate exclamations completed by shrugs, in interrupted phrases, in hints ending in deep sighs. Ultimately, both Marlowe and Kurtz confront a conflict between their images of themselves as civilized Europeans and the temptation to abandon morality completely once they leave the context of Europe and European codes of rationality and order. I'm going to quote perhaps what is the most crucial passage in this novella, and which you will have eventually to reflect about. Conrad writes that the conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it is the idea only, an idea at the back of it, not a sentimental pretense, but an idea, and an unselfish belief in that idea, something you can set up and bow down before and offer a sacrifice to. He's speaking about the idea at the heart of the colonial enterprise, conquest. Conquest in search of profit. Conrad, in his colonial fictions, did not presume to speak for the colonial peoples. So he was not addressing the colonial peoples in Heart of Darkness. He was addressing the audience of Blackwood's magazine, which was the magazine in which he regularly published his writings. And the audience of Blackwoods was what we would call an upper class, white, male oriented readership, which had a very conservative view and a very strong belief in the invincibility of the British Empire. Imperialism in Conrad's time had monopolized the entire system of representing other places. And in Heart of Darkness, this allowed it to speak for Africans as well as for Kurds and the other adventurers. At the very beginning of his account, Marlowe elicits two important parallels that I would like you to notice. He elicits a parallel, as he initiates his narrative, between the Roman colonization of Britain long before it became a civilization, with an inverted commas, and the contemporary British imperialism. Referring to the Thames, Marlowe utters these words, "And this also has been one of the dark places of the earth." Marlowe draws another implicit parallel between the River Thames and the Dark River in the Belgian colony. The Thames is described as a waterway leading to the uttermost ends of the earth, hence implying that it shares a common fate and common features with the savage stream that exists in the unknown. And this interconnected history of both rivers should remind us of what Edward Said wrote later about the inextricable relation between colonizer and colonized, that these are histories that cannot be simplistically detached from each other. And Conrad was already preempting this discourse when he connects both rivers into one continuum. So when Marlowe embarks upon his trip and ventures into the actual colonial context, the colony itself, that redeeming idea of empire, the space of conquest, it takes on an increasingly questionable and disturbing role. So that purported efficiency, that purported enlightenment that Kurtz was so famous for back in Europe, through Marlowe's experience, is translating itself into something much more monstrous and much more horrendous. For instance, when he's at the central station, he notices that, I quote, "When a truckle bed with a sick man was put in there, the chief accountant exhibited a gentle annoyance. The groans of this sick person," he said, "distract my attention. And without that, it is extremely difficult to guard against clerical errors in this climate." So the colonial agents themselves, they display this cold-blooded indifference towards the black slaves they were meant to supervise. And Conrad is exploring throughout the novella, he is exploring the imperialist frame of mind and its inherent contradictions. So beneath the icon that was Kurtz in Europe, there is this sordid reality of brutal oppression. As Marlowe journeys from the outer station into the central station and further up the river, we realize that what his experience narrates is intended to subvert, on the one hand, to subvert the whole idea behind imperialism. The incidents he encounters suggest an institution, the colonial institution, based on slavery, torture, and cruelty towards native inhabitants. And I quote, this is earlier on in the novella, and Marlowe says, "Black shapes crouched, lay, sat between trees, leaning against the trunks, clinging to the earth, half coming out, half effaced." Notice this half coming out, half effaced. "Within the dim light, in all the attitudes of pain, abandonment, and despair." So, in a sense, we can say that Heart of Darkness subverts imperialism's claim to be the agent of progress and to be in possession of all knowledge. This is one side of it. So, we can think of Heart of Darkness to some extent as a critique of imperialism, a narrative that interrogates the workings of colonialist machinery in Central Africa. On the other hand, however, it is not only a critique, it is itself deformed by its complicity, its involvement, its collusion with colonialist racism. So while his description of the black workers suggests the harsh realities of the colonial enterprise, in reality, his own vision, his own semantics in the novel display a certain deep-seated prejudicial attitude towards these people. He describes them as effaced, erased, shapes, niggers, creatures. He's pandering to the condescending imperialist viewpoint here. And he's pandering to his readers. So in a sense, this is what his readers wanted to hear. His readers were expecting these narratives of the colonial imagination, these narratives that would describe dark places that are outside Europe's zone of rationality and order. Again, Chinua Achebe accuses Marlowe's implicit criticism of the system. So when Marlowe elicits the atrocities of colonialism, Achebe says, listen, Conrad here is paying lip service to the Africans. He calls it a bleeding heart sentiment that can in no way account for Conrad's dehumanizing depiction of the black workers. One could equally argue, however, that the further inland Marlowe journeys, the more vividly his account exposes the contradictory and hypocritical rhetoric which was used to make the colonial venture sound legitimate. The colonial exploitation of local people is masked as a trade working hand in hand with the cause of the civilizing mission. One impression Marlowe gets of Kurtz, the initial impression, is of Kurtz as the ultimate guardian of the European colonialist virtues of this cause. So Kurtz is described as a prodigy, I'm quoting, an emissary of pity and science and progress, an agent entrusted by Europe because of his higher intelligence, wide sympathies, a singleness of purpose. Likewise, the station is not only meant to be a center for trade, but a beacon on the road towards better things, a center for humanizing, improving, instructing. Note the Enlightenment intertext that was used by colonialist politics. The idea of civilizing, enlightening, missionizing, the other, othering the unknown spaces of the earth. And the alleged virtue of Kurt is depicted early on at the central station when there is a small sketch in oils on a panel representing a woman draped and blindfolded carrying a torch, and this Kurt himself has painted. So this implicitly reflects his stature as a beacon of civilization. However, the true singleness of his purpose, of Kurt's purpose, which was so well known in Europe and so iconic, emerges very strongly in the scribbled note he leaves in his paper on the suppression of those who have read the episode of Kurt's paper on the suppression of savage customs. And there is this scribbled slight note at the bottom of one page, exterminate all the brutes. Exterminate all the brutes. Incidentally, it is the phrase which provides the title for Noam Chomsky's essay on Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip last year. Exterminate all the brutes, which in a sense encompasses the implicit violence at the heart of any imperial enterprise. So Kurt's virtue in reality boils down to his brutal raids of several inland tribes in his greedy quest for looting, and looting, if possible, the entirety of the continent's ivory. And Kurt's greed, Kurt's symbolic greed as an allegory of empire, is very clear in the following words. It was as though an animated image of death carved out of old ivory had been shaking its hand with menaces at a motionless crowd of men made of dark and glittering bronze. I saw him, that is Kurtz, opening his mouth wide. It gave him a weirdly voracious aspect, as though he had wanted to swallow all the air, all the earth, all the men before him. So Kurtz has set himself as the quintessential light of civilization, something for others to bow down before and to offer sacrifice to. And as such, he comes to stand for the worst form of degeneracy hidden behind the veil of the civilizing mission. This mission is made up, as Marlowe points out, of hunters for gold or pursuers of fame, all gone out on that stream, bearing the sword and often the torch, messengers of the might within the land. So his journey, Marlowe's journey, comes to symbolize a quest for coming to terms with the inconvenient truth behind the rhetoric of colonization. Going up that river, he writes, was like traveling back to the earliest beginnings of the world, when vegetation rioted the earth, and the big trees were kings, an empty stream, a great silence, an impenetrable forest. The magnificence, the dark, violent magnificence of the forest comes to be proportional here to the extent of the savagery of the colonial enterprise. So Marlowe's reflection on the great river preempts another force. His reflections on the force of nature preempt the force of colonialism, another force that rioted the earth in search of profit this time around. An enterprise that lies not only at the very heart of empire, but implicitly in Conrad, at the heart of human nature itself. Ultimately, the silent wilderness that Marlowe is describing, the living trees, like evil or truth, come to represent the evil truth at the heart of the colonial enterprise, which Marlowe increasingly recognizes in his journey upstream. We find that very, very clear, symbiosis between the grass sprouting out of the cobblestones in the dark metropolis of Brussels and the grass sprouting out of the ribs of a dead man in the heart of darkness, right? So this image of the grass sprouting out of the earth, these little tufts of grass in Brussels that then reach their dark, ferocious zenith in the heart of Africa. You have this idea of the magnified violence of empire once it operates in the context of subjecting other communities. So the river itself may be read as a European way into the heart of the continent. So the river is passing through the land, right? Without involving itself as such, or without having to bother as such about the heartlands. It's a passage through the land. It crosses the land without actually engaging with it. And this, in a sense, is also a metaphor for the colonial enterprise. The voyage through the river without having to concern oneself with the knowledge of the heartlands. So seen in this way, we also have to reflect on Marlowe's progress towards Kurtz as a progress away from the logic of civilization. So the closer Marlowe gets to Kurtz, who represents the ultimate descent into moral deterioration, the more his rational mind loses its bearings, and the forest seems to fall into a trance. He says, the current ran smooth and swift, but a dumb immobility sat on the banks. It was not asleep. It seemed unnatural, like a state of trance. So there's this very crucial sense in which Marlowe, as a colonial agent at the end of the day, is losing the bearings of rational order. So the signifying order of civilization starts losing its patterns the further Marlowe delves towards his encounter with Kurtz. And this is reflected in the fact, for instance, that the original title of this novella was The Heart of Darkness. But Conrad had second thoughts, because The Heart of Darkness is, in putting that article over there, he is specifying this space too much for his readers. He wanted to elicit this feeling of an exciting, an intriguing space beyond the borders of European rationality. So he removed, he slashed out the article, the, and he just left it with Heart of Darkness, which implies a timeless and spaceless milieu, right? That was there for the Europeans to discover, as a space that is at once dangerous and exciting, Heart of Darkness. This gradual loss of civilization, signifying order, is evident in Marlowe's joy when he stumbles across Towson's book, his inquiry into some points of seamanship. Why? Because the inquiry into seamanship in Towson's book was a representation of the European codes and norms of rationality. So when Marlowe comes across this beacon, this epitome of colonial expansion and colonial rationality and its oppression of other peoples, and he comes across this coded description of seamanship, he feels an immediate familiarity to it. And when he had to leave it, when it had to leave off, he writes that, "I assure you, to leave off reading was like tearing myself away from the shelter of an old and solid friendship." Now, this incident, his coming upon the Towson's inquiry into the points of seamanship, it marks the crucial moment when Marlowe has to leave behind any rational category he uses on the continent and immerse himself into Kerr's descent into moral chaos. So Marlowe's recoil from the primal and the primitive in the heart of the jungle coexists with the unspeakable fear of what lies beyond Europe's zones of cognition. Marlowe is unable, for instance, to tell what the role of drums might signify as he makes his way upstream, or whether the prehistoric man, I quote, was either cursing us, praying to us, welcoming us. These are unfamiliar realities which Marlowe's frame of mind could not come to grips with, could not understand. This irrational mode in which he describes the jungle, the river, the world, the rolling of the drums, this irrational mode reaches its climax in Kurtz himself. Kurtz is described by Marlowe as mad. And Kurt's insanity is depicted as coming from the headstrong detachment from the social context of civilization. His insanity is not only linked to the quest for absolute power, which is intrinsic to empire. Kurtz is also a European individual who has no more authority to answer to but the wilderness. So Kurtz is the entity that blasts the norms of power, hierarchy, and authority, and invalidates the codes of behavior that Marlowe presumes as his point of departure. These codes of behavior just disappear. And one implicit idea here is that colonialism loses meaning to itself at the point at which it achieves the full extent of its megalomania. So at the point at which the colonial enterprise betrays its own desires, betrays its own devices. This is Kurtz. Kurtz is a betrayal of the very desire of colonial fullness. Marlowe describes him as hollow at the core. Marlowe's image of a completely uncontrollable Kurtz, a Kurtz that is beyond the codes of European deportment, attests precisely to this dark knowledge, and he describes Kurtz as the memory of gratified and monstrous passions. This alone, I was convinced, had driven him out to the edge of the forest, to the bush, beyond the bounds of permitted aspirations. And don't you see, the terror of the position was not in being knocked on the head, but in this, that I had to deal with a being to whom I could not appeal in the name of anything high or low, a being to whom Marlowe could not, a being whom Marlowe could not judge in terms of the cause of behavior expected by the colonial agents. This sense of irrationality that Conrad portrays, so the further he goes into the jungle, the more vague and ambiguous the knowledge of the surroundings becomes. And this sense of rationality is criticized very harshly by Achebe, who accuses Conrad of depicting an Africa that is some kind of frenzied antithesis to Europe and other civilizations. So Conrad accuses Conrad of othering Africa, a place where man's vaunted intelligence and refinement are finally mocked by triumphant bestiality. So this is, according to Achebe, this irrational evocation of Africa is, according to Achebe, the tragic aspect of Conrad's novella. Incidentally, when Achebe was asked whether he thought that the novella was like a great work, a great canonical work of literature, I said no. He said an outright no. And he called Conrad a bloody racist. But we'll come to that later. On the other hand, Marlowe's voyage downriver, away from curves, is rendered easier. The journey back to civilization is smoother, even though they were traveling on a lame steamboat. But the steamboat picks up speeds on its way back to civilization. However, in spite of the fact that Marlowe wanted to dismiss the memory of Kurtz, he couldn't dismiss the memory of Kurtz because he was ultimately entrusted with the care of Kurtz's papers, his continuing legacy, which he had to take with him back to Europe to Kurtz's intended wife. Marlowe has grown intimate with Kurtz. Incidentally, this intimacy with Kurtz is also reflected in the fact that Henry Stanley was entrusted with David Livingstone's papers when he found him on Lake Tanganyika. So there is perhaps this relation was in Conrad's mind when he created this affinity between Kurtz and Marlowe. And Kurtz knows Marlowe knows Kurtz. I quote, "As you peer down at a man who is lying at the bottom of a precipice where the sun never shines." In Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now, there is the scene where Kurtz dies. Where he says, the horror. And there is a certain kind of dusty smoke coming out of his mouth. It reminds me also of a few verses from Shakespeare's Macbeth, when Shakespeare writes, "And all our yesterdays have dusted fools their way to dusty debts." Okay, the idea that "and all our yesterdays have lighted fools." Sorry, their way to dusty debts. The idea that the colonial enterprise, as embodied in Kurtz, is ultimately a hollow piece of foolishness. This is a very memorable scene that I think Coppola's adaptation really captures in a very powerful way from the novella. So Marlowe's voyage back to civilization is ultimately a quest intended to uphold the lie at the heart of empire, the lie of a brutal conquest beneath the appearance of civility. So the knowledge of the atrocities perpetrated by Kurtz will ultimately have to remain unspoken in order to uphold the idea of imperial enlightenment. So despite the hollowness of the colonialist rationale which Marlowe brings up, and the evil depiction of social norms in the novella. Marlowe depicts these as this hollowness as ultimately necessary for the perpetuation of cohesion and order in the metropolis. We have to know that we are not only speaking of the metropolis of we would assume Brussels in Marlowe's narrative, but Marlowe is narrating aboard the Nelly, which is moored at the very heart of another imperial capital, London. So Marlowe lies to Kurtz Intended. When Kurtz Intended asks him what were Kurtz's final words, and Marlowe says he mentioned your name. And in fact, Kurtz had uttered words that evoked, I quote, the colossal scale of his vile desires, the meanness, the torment, the tempestuous anguish of his soul. These are words that Marlowe conveniently hides from the Intended. He also removes Kurtz's notes, exterminate the brute, in order to uphold his image as an exemplary genius of civility. But the knowledge that Marlowe carries with him and shares with his audience, but not with the Intended, is that the wilderness had claimed Kurtz's soul and fascinated him. It echoed loudly within him because he was hollow at the core. Okay, I would like to say a few words now about the reception of the novella. I would trust that you would delve into this text with a critical eye to its politics in the representation of women, for example. There are many aspects that it is impossible to deal with in a one-hour lecture. What I call the chiaroscuro signification of the novella, the images of light and darkness that are recurring throughout Heart of Darkness, and how is Conrad uses them in order to elicit a certain politics of empire and a critique of empire, this dialectic that is happening on the steamboat as Marlowe describes his surroundings. I wish I had more time to delve into this. It is realistic to argue that African Heart of Darkness, often without much explanation, is held responsible for mental deterioration and physical illness. Achebe points out that Conrad is concerned not so much with Africa. This is Achebe's point. Conrad is not concerned with Africa here, but with depicting the deterioration of one European mind, Kurtz. He's saying that Conrad is mobilizing this whole groundswell of African geography, the dark jungle, this unnerving mystery of the Congo, this exoticism, only in order to be able to explicate, to accommodate the story of one European soul. Achebe argues that Conrad's depiction of Africa and Africans is thoroughly racist, and that Conrad reduces Africa, I quote, to a prop for the breakup of one petty European mind. The major point of Achebe's criticism is the novella's descriptions of African characters, which reproduce the dehumanization of Africa, I'm quoting Achebe, the dehumanization of Africa and Africans with which this age-long attitude has fostered and continues to foster in the world. Achebe picks on manifestly, of course Achebe has an agenda here, like Nepal had an agenda, which is the polar opposite of Achebe's. I'll come to it very soon. Achebe picks on manifestly racist passages, such as the following. Well, that was the worst of it. I'm quoting Conrad's Heart of Darkness. This suspicion of their not being inhuman, it would come slowly to one. They howled and leaped and spun and made horrid faces. But what thrilled you was just the thought of their humanity, like yours. The thought of your remote kinship with this wild and passionate uproar. Ugly. With regard to this presentation of Africa, we know that the black figures in Conrad's unearthly landscape are described as belonging to the beginning of time. Their speech is described as savage, and their souls are described as rudimentary, basic. And Conrad is unnerved. Conrad is well and true unnerved by the idea of his own distant kinship, relation with these creatures, so-called creatures. And his description itself is a means of asserting his cultural superiority and authority over these objects he is describing. In response to this vision of Africa, Achebe writes that, I quote, "The question is whether a novel which celebrates this dehumanization, which depersonalizes a portion of the human race, can be called a great work of art. My answer is no, it cannot. Even after due allowances have been made for all the influences of contemporary prejudice on his sensibility, there remains still in Conrad's attitude a residue of antipathy to black people, which his peculiar psychology alone can explain." So, in a sense, after such criticism, it is plausible or possible to argue that Conrad's novella, Heart of Darkness itself, has a hand when you consider the huge readership. It's one of the best read texts of all time. It's huge exposure in the West and in other places where the idea of the West carries a lot of clout. We cannot ignore the fact that Heart of Darkness has had a hand in these dehumanizing practices, in this depiction, in the oppression of non-white peoples. Benita Parry sees Achebe's criticism as inadequate to an understanding of what she calls the novella's plural registers. She says there are more semantic layers that we need to uncover. It is not only the dehumanizing aspect that Achebe is writing about here. She was also critical of V.S. Naipaul, because V.S. Naipaul just declared that Conrad had written a totally accurate reportage of the world's half-made societies. Right? These are his words, that Conrad had written an accurate reportage of the world's half-made societies, lacking in any goal and which seemed doomed to remain half-made in an empty world. I quote Naipaul, and his words would come across as outrageous, I would say. "To arrive at this sense of country trapped and static," he's discussing Africa here, and in particular the Congo Basin. "To arrive at this sense of country trapped and static, eternally vulnerable, is to begin to have something of the African sense of the void." So Naipaul is basically saying, these are societies incapable of producing their own history, which would again could again offer us an opportunity for serious debate. I mean, the fact that such a writer with so much purchase in on the world literary scenario and a lot of credibility among millions of readers comes up with such a bold and boldly prejudicial statement. Okay. So Parry argues that in reading the novella in through their very own agendas, both Achebe and Naipaul are closing off an understanding of a fiction that reflects on its own misrecognitions. A fiction that reflects on its own misrecognitions. This is a very good definition of the novella. You have a colonial agent, Marlowe, who is very often critical of what his political background is perpetrating. Okay, as a last thought, before I come to a close. With regard to the politics and the ongoing politics that arise from the writing of such a novella, we have the paradox here, and Parry dwells on this. We have the paradox between a turn-of-the-century novel that concedes that it cannot articulate a world that is its subject. So the intransigence of the Congolese darkness that Marlowe is writing about. There is also a sense in which Marlowe knows he can never articulate an experience that is alien to him, who has come there with a colonialist missionizing baggage. So there's a paradox between this and the Congo itself, which some 50 years later rejected Belgian rule. And in 1960, the year of the Congo's independence was very interesting in this respect, because on the very independence ceremony itself, King Baudouin, which is the grandson of King Leopold II, was invited to speak. And he argued that the independence of the Congo is the result of the undertaking achieved by the genius of King Leopold II. So he actually had the guts to say this. And immediately there was Patrice Lumumba's retort, Congo's first prime minister, who said, "Let us not forget that this independence is owed to the fact that the people of Congo rejected Belgian rule." Lumumba spoke of the oppression and atrocities of colonialism, and noted that the fight for independence was achieved through the sweat of long years of oppression for the people of Congo. Well, I hope you enjoyed this lecture. If anyone has any questions, I will be here for next 10 minutes if you want to ask something. Thank you.